Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the future of the city of Chicago, and we hope also have the opportunity to say some things about the futures of cities more generally. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that some civic leaders in Chicago have put together in a book which is titled Chicago Metropolis 2020, The Chicago Plan for the 21st Century. It's available in a book form. It's published by University of Chicago Press. The very last time that there was a comprehensive plan for the growth, the shape, the future of the city was 1909. And that plan, often referred to as the Burnham Plan because of the involvement of Daniel Burnham, noted architect, that really did serve as a guiding light for a lot of people in a lot of cities ever afterwards. However, the folks in Chicago there felt that perhaps the city had changed significantly. It was facing different problems, and so we needed something new. And now, over a number of years, there have been various kinds of conversations and meetings, and one result has been this plan that's presented in this book. We'll try and talk a little bit about what's in here, but as I say, also maybe say some things about cities in general. And our guest for the program is Elmer Johnson. He's the author of this book, Chicago Metropolis 2020. He's president of the Aspen Institute. He's counsel to the law firm of Kirkland & Ellis, where he was a managing partner for many years. He's also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And we're very pleased that he can be with us and spend some time here on Focus 580 this morning. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. If there are folks listening in Chicago, you may use our toll-free line and participate in the conversation. It won't cost you anything. Of course, anyone for whom it would be a long-distance call can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We also, though, have a number here for folks in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. That's 333-9455. So anyone is welcome to call at any point. We just ask people to try to be brief just so we can get in as many different folks as possible. And our guest, Elmer Johnson, talking with us from the offices of the University of Chicago Press. We're pleased that they, folks there, could help us with this high-quality connection this morning. Mr. Johnson, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much. And thanks for talking with us.
Absolutely.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more, or I could ask you to talk a little bit more about how it is that this came, how it is Chicago Metropolis 2020 actually came to be. Because this is, as my understanding, this is the result of a number of conversations by a number of groups of people that have been taking place now over a number of years.
Yes, I had a dream about this, and I was a member of the Commercial Club, which became the sponsor in '96 of this 3-year effort. And this is the same club that sponsored the Burnham Plan in 1906 to 1909. So this was history repeating itself, and I gave a talk to the club in March of '96 and proposed that it was time for a new dream, that this club had sponsored a most important plan, the Burnham Plan, that came out in 1909, and I talked about the influence that it had over the subsequent decades, but that circumstances had radically changed since then, and that it was really up to us, the business and professional leaders of Chicago, if we were to help ensure that Chicago and the metropolis remain the vibrant economic region with a high quality of life and great equity of opportunity that we are striving to achieve. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason for the new plan and basically the different circumstances. You alluded to the old Burnham Plan, where the problem he addressed, the key problem he addressed, was the over-concentration of people. They were all huddled downtown around the packing houses, the railroad terminals, the manufacturing facilities. Gradually, they were spreading out thanks to light rail, but it was the beginning of the automobile era, and his vision was a much more spread-out metropolis where people could breathe and clean air and have a little land to enjoy and recreational opportunities. So it was quite a different situation from today where, as you know, the common complaint around the country is that we've spread out. We've done too good a job of spreading out. It's called sprawl, or low-density, unlimited sprawl. And so there are lots of regions in the United States, metropolitan regions, that have begun to address this problem. That was one of the problems we addressed, but only one.
It seems that for the folks there who and for Mr. Burnham in 1909, one of the main concerns, not the only one, but one of the main concerns was really was aesthetics. It seems that now that we're here at this point and we're talking about this Chicago metropolis 2020, that economic development may be the lead concern. Certainly, a lot of things in this address quality of life issues. But is it correct, do you think, that now really it is economics that drive this?
No, I do not. I think that is certainly a goal we want to achieve, but how you get there is quite a different matter. Mm-hmm. And what's become clear to me over the years of planning and writing this book is that quality of life is everything, almost everything, equity of opportunity and quality of life. And if you work on those two goals, I think economic vibrancy will be the result. Now, let me just explain, because I don't think that Daniel Burnham was into aesthetics just for the sake of aesthetics. Mm. He was passionately concerned about the quality of life people should be able to lead. And he was primarily concerned with the poor working class who could not get away from Chicago, could not get away from their miserable working conditions. And so one of his principles was the lake is for everyone, and it should be preserved by a series of lakefront parks, which turned out to be the case, 8 miles long. And it did become the lake for everyone. And so too, in the case of the forest preserves and the park system that he advocated so strongly. So it was all about quality of life, and today it is no different. It is the cities that provide the highest quality of life in terms of cultural opportunities, recreational opportunities, and all kinds of other opportunities, educational opportunities, that will make all the difference in whether we attract the right kind of talent. Remember, we live in an economy today where educated skills are everything. It's no longer the primary reason for economic vibrancy as to where the physical capital is located. It's where the brains are located. And if we can be a metropolis that attracts some of the best brains in the world, we will continue to maintain our economic vibrancy. And the way you do that, since the most talented people are pretty footloose and fancy-free, they are going to go to the cities that they find most attractive as places in which to live.
Hmm. I'm certain that Chicago shares some qualities with other large cities, but there also must be some things that set it apart. In what ways would you say Chicago is unique?
It has a historical legacy of being the railroad center of the nation. That has given us an opportunity to deal with excessive automobile dependency in ways that most other cities don't have. Because of that legacy, we are also becoming by far the most important center for transferring goods, intermodal transfer center from between truck and rail. That has become a very important feature of the last 10 years as railroads are starting to make a comeback thanks to this intermodal traffic between truck and rail. Those are two examples. And then I would say the fact that from a very early date, we are the only city that preserved the lakefront for recreational purposes to be enjoyed by all the people. No other city on the Great Lakes did that. Toronto is making valiant efforts now, but Chicago has been doing this for 100 years. And so that in turn attracted people to live downtown. And I doubt if there's any city in the United States of this size or anywhere near this size that is so attractive for people who want to reside in the downtown core. Dallas, other cities are trying very hard to do what Chicago has done, but we've been at it for 100 years. Those are some of the great advantages, and to say nothing of the great educational institutions, University of Chicago, Northwestern, and quite a number of others.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Elmer Johnson. He's president of the Aspen Institute. He is also the author of this book that we've mentioned. It's titled Chicago Metropolis 2020, The Chicago Plan for the 21st Century, published by the University of Chicago Press. And questions are welcome from, if we have folks listening in Chicago, but anyone else is certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Just to pick one issue out of many that you've just touched on, transportation, I grew up in Cook County and have occasion to be up there a couple of times a year at least because I still have family there. And I certainly know there are a lot of people on the roads. People drive there a lot. And it's very striking how much, how the volume of traffic has gone up. The number of miles of roads haven't gone up particularly, but I know over the last couple of decades the volume has gone up considerably. That can lead to a great deal of congestion. I wonder what you're thinking about along those lines, and particularly whether there's some possibility that public transportation, mass transit, could be put to greater use here in this region, that because people have spread out so much from the city, there seems to be such a heavy reliance on the on personal transportation.
We do propose a set of answers to that dilemma because this trend that you described so well is one that is going to become more and more aggravated. And the time that people spend in gridlock keeps increasing year after year. We cannot build roads fast enough to accommodate these kinds of land use patterns. And so, in a nutshell, what we're proposing is that for the first time in history, we try to think about transportation and land use on an integrated basis. Let me give you an example. Suppose that half of the suburban population, today, probably 90% of the suburban population live in single-family homes, with attached garages on single lots. You can suppose a very different time, where perhaps up to half of the suburban population, 50 years from now, might live in concentrated centers of 200,000 or so. In townhomes or apartment buildings. Not everybody would choose to live that way. Many raising families would choose quite otherwise. But then there are many people who do not have children, who are dual-career families, and maybe they do have children, who want to live in a different style that is not available to them at present. Now, as you know, it takes a critical mass if you're going to have a major rail transit stop. Ideally, you should have perhaps a couple hundred thousand people living in fairly close proximity to that stop. Downtown Chicago, of course, we have 600,000, 800,000 people living in a fairly concentrated area. If we had a number of centers, not that big, but say 200,000 on average, and perhaps 10 of them spread around the suburban areas, then we could support a much higher level of transit traffic, and there would be a much better balance between public transit and automobile transit. People would be able to make choices. If none of them chose this more concentrated style of living, then our thesis would be disproved. But right now, the zoning powers are so localized that it is impossible to think about land use planning and transportation planning on a regional basis.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, someone here in Urbana. We will do that. They're on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Sounds like a fascinating book. I grew up in Chicago, and I went to Chicago Public Schools. And even then, since I went to two different high schools, I moved from a school that did not have high expectations to a high school that had very high expectations. So back then, back in the 50s, there was still a disparity of how good the schools were in Chicago. And I wonder if your plan addresses education.
Yes, I'm glad you brought it up. It is our highest priority. And, in fact, it's the first chapter in the book and probably the first city plan in history to take on education as the highest priority of any metropolitan plan. The reasons are pretty overwhelming. The Illinois Constitution guarantees, it's never lived up to this guarantee, but it guarantees an equally high education, public education, for every child in the state of Illinois. And, of course, we've never come close to taking that constitutional provision seriously in the Chicago area. I think the mayor is trying as hard as it's possible to do to catch up, but it's a very slow process when things have been so bad for so long. So, yes, we do tackle that. Part of it is financial. Namely, schools are financed off of the property tax base, and the property tax base in some localities is 30 times per capita what it is in other areas.
Would you explain that, please?
Yeah. Let's say you live in Kenilworth, and let's say the average home is $400,000 in value. You tax those homes at fairly little in the way of a rate, because those homes also have few children compared to, say, a populous but poor suburb on the south side, where the average home may be worth only $40,000 or $50,000, and they're loaded with children. So you have very high educational costs because of the number of children in the community and a very low property tax base to levy property taxes on. The result is that the rich Kenilworth can spend four times per student and tax their people at a much less rate as the poor suburb on the south side or west side. And what has been happening here, we started these reforms at the Commercial Club, certainly took a great deal of initiative in furthering these reforms, and some of them have been accomplished to narrow that gap by providing a base, saying that something like $4,300 per student is the minimum that shall be spent.
What is it now in the Chicago area?
Well, the highest schools, the richest schools, would be spending $16,000 per student.
And you advocate?
Well, we have advocated raising that bottom up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the only answer, of course. We have advocated a complex of measures. That's one on the financial side. The other, and that might be accomplished by in part by a state tax and get away from the local tax, because it shouldn't be an accident. The child's quality of education should not be an accident of whether they can afford to live in a poor suburb or a very rich suburb. If we really believe in equality of opportunity, then we should finance it very differently than the way we do. So whether that's a state property tax or a state income tax, the answer is that, I think the solution has to be in large part that we get away from financing the schools totally on a local basis.
Right.
Now, that, as I say, is not the only problem. We have a even bigger problem. How do you attract top quality people into the teaching profession, into the profession of being a principal? A great principal can attract great teachers, but we haven't taken this all very seriously. And it's all been made much worse in a day and age of dual career families where women have fortunately the opportunity to compete with men in just about any kind of business or profession today. And so they say to themselves, why should I go into teaching like my mother or grandmother did, when that and nursing were the only things they could think of doing? So we've got a real problem attracting good people. I do believe that there are ways around that we can do a lot of things to improve the quality of people going into the profession. I think universities and colleges, the best ones, should take much more interest. There's a lot of idealism around, and I think people, if they had responsibility, they'll make this pay sacrifices, but they won't do it if they have to put up with all kinds of red tape and bureaucracy, which is the present case. So much of our set of solutions had to do with how we get rid of the bureaucratic red tape so as to make it a more attractive place to work, where people get the kind of responsibility they get in the business world. And then I'd say the third measure was a measure of school choice. We feel that competition is good. We have competition among universities and colleges, of course. But when it comes to public schools, we're only beginning now to experiment with charter schools and vouchers. And so besides governance reforms of the kind I've been talking about and taxation reforms, some measure of school choice, it would be analogous to the kind of competition the Japanese auto industry beneficially gave to the American auto industry in the early 80s, which made them wake up and said, my God, we don't rule the world after all. We don't have 95% of the market. We actually have to compete with the Japanese, and they started making better cars. So we think while the public school system should be our primary concern, a little competition would be good for them.
Mm-hmm. I saw the movie Hoop Dreams about
yes.
two young men in high school, each looking to make a name for themselves in basketball.
Yes.
And one of the young men went to Marshall High School, which was an inner city school. And I was very saddened to see it was either an English class or a social studies class where only three or four of the students showed up that day.
Yes.
And it saddened me because I had also gone to Marshall High School back in the very early 50s. And I wondered how a school can educate its children when children are not motivated to even go to class.
Yes. Well,
and I was very saddened by that scene.
It is very sad because perhaps, as you and I can recall, every once in a while we'd have a teacher that was so inspiring that would raise our sights, elevate our vision, and give us a dream we didn't have before. And that would stick with me or you the rest of our lives. And that's what took me back and gave me that burning desire to know more about English literature. So it is very sad. And Aspen Institute itself, we are now starting a program for talented young teachers and principals to explore these very questions. How do we get more people like you? What policy reforms do we have to make to make it more attractive to people like you? Because of all people, you should know you are the best. And we've got to start exalting the best and learning from them. They are on the front lines, and they more than anybody know what we ought to be doing, both to attract more highly qualified teachers and also to retain them, because the turnover rate is horrendous. About a third of new hires in the teaching of public schools in Chicago leave within 5 years.
We're already at our midpoint here, and I need to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. I appreciate her comments. I have a couple of other people I'd like to get to. And also, I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in on the last little bit. We're speaking with Elmer Johnson. He is president of the Aspen Institute. He is an attorney. He's of counsel to the law firm of Kirkland & Ellis, where he was a managing partner for many years. He's also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and is the author of this book that we've mentioned. If you're interested in cities, urban planning, or the city of Chicago, you might look at this book. It's titled Chicago Metropolis 2020, The Chicago Plan for the 21st Century, published by the University of Chicago Press, in which there are a number of ideas presented for dealing with different sorts of issues, including public education, also transportation, land use, governance, and so forth for the city of Chicago, but not just for the city of Chicago, not just Cook County, but also for the surrounding counties of Lake, McHenry, Kane, Will, and DuPage. And questions here are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just one question real quick, Mr. Johnson, just to follow up on some of your comments about school funding. It seems to me that for at least a couple of decades now, we have been talking on and off in this state about changing the school funding mechanism and trying to move away from our reliance on the property taxes being the main funding source for the very problem that you cite. That is, it leads to these great inequities in the dollars that districts can put behind students. And it seems that it's something that the General Assembly simply seems unwilling or perhaps unable to change? Do you think that it's possible, politically possible, that any time in the near future we would see a change in this?
Well, we have seen change. Unfortunately, it's been very incremental. But we've had Blue Ribbon commissions over the last 10 years, and there have been two rounds of reforms that went through. So we've basically gotten from, as I recall, something like $3,500 per pupil up to close to $4,500 per pupil. It's progress of a sort. It doesn't narrow the gap. Other states have tried more radical things, and the politicians have gotten thrown out as a result. So it's politically very difficult, given our degree of localism. You see, we have 1,200 units of local government, including over 300 school districts, and they're not about to give up their authority and their own taxing powers, and they defy any politician to go too far on this. Mm-hmm. So in part, that's why our firm addresses this governance issue, that they're really, it's going to be very difficult to solve a lot of these problems without some kind of governance reform.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we get back to that, but I do have some other folks here, so
yes.
I don't want to make them continue to wait. We'll go on to another Urbana caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have two questions. The first is about the traffic and gridlock, and the second is about your institute. The first about the traffic and gridlock is I've always wondered about the L train in Chicago. I think the latest fare was $1.50 one way, and I've always thought that if they could lower the fare, I think that when every time the fare goes up, there's somebody else that says, "Oh, nuts! I'm going to drive to work. It's cheaper to drive than to take the L." And I've always thought that if they lowered the fare way down, more people would take the L, and there would be less traffic and gridlock. I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, it's quite a conundrum, because ridership has gone down every year until about a year ago when it started going up again. So there seems to be a connection between how bad gridlock gets and when people are saying, you know, I can get downtown much quicker by the elevated than I can by my car, and it's going to be hassle-free. I can read while I'm on the train. But when you start reducing the fares, and they tried that, then they don't have the capital expenditures to maintain the train system. So we have to figure out, you know, we really, one of the things we advocated was a higher degree of subsidization. To break this conundrum, to deal with this conundrum. And I think we're going to have to go through a period where we just make a capital investment to significantly upgrade the quality of the rail system so that it is much more appealing. A lot of people don't know how much automobile transportation is subsidized. The private auto is the most highly subsidized. You know, we build a highway system, and it's there for our use, rent-free. We pay for it ultimately in taxes of some kind. But the average commuter coming in from a suburb to the central city of Chicago, according to a Harvard professor, pays for about 25% of the cost of his or her travel on a user basis, on a pay-as-you-go basis. The rest we all pay in general taxes of one kind or another. So it's a very strange system we have, where people have a false illusion that it doesn't cost them nearly as much to drive as it really does. They just have a false picture. And so part of the answer is to give people a little truer idea of what it costs them to drive during gridlock. And of course, in modern electronic means, there are cities around the United States that impose congestion pricing at peak hour travel periods, and then people say, "Well, I think maybe I'll spend a little less on that pricing, road pricing, and I'll try drive at a different time, or I'll take a different form of transportation, or I'll carpool." So, pricing travel more correctly is certainly a part of the answer.
Well, it seems to me if there was less traffic, there'd be less wear and tear on the roads, there'd be less maintenance, and then they could use that money to subsidize the L train.
You're right, and look at how heavily truck travel is subsidized. It's because of the subsidization of truck travel. They're getting a, and of course trucks impose most of the damage on the highways, not cars. Mm-hmm. And then we wonder why our rail system, our freight rail system, is not in better shape.
Because
they had to build their own roadbeds, and the trucks did not.
All right. Well, I had another question about the name of your institute is Aspen Institute,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to know why you named it that, because when I think of Aspen, I think of aspen trees in Aspen, Colorado.
Well, it was created 50 years ago by some Chicagoans, including some people from University of Chicago, where I'm sitting today, and it was really the dreamer of it all. Walter Pepke was a businessman in Chicago. And he had this inspiration when he got to this mountainside of Aspen, an old mining town, in late 40s, right after the war. And he said, what if we could create a place of renewal, spiritual renewal, mental renewal, physical renewal, for people in the business and professional world who tend to narrow their minds with each passing decade as they concentrate on the bottom line. He said, we could enlarge their souls. We could get them back in touch with the great books, inspiring literature. And so it was formed in 1950, and it's been going ever since, and we had the best summer in our history this year. I think people who make a lot of money by their late 30s often get an empty feeling in their stomach and say, is this it? Is this all there is? And those kind of people, we hope, are leaders who could have a tremendous impact on the rest of society. So that's the story.
And again, I hope the caller will forgive me. We're moving into our last about 15 minutes, and we have some others and want to continue. Let's go to line number three. This will be Champagne. Hello?
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I understand that Chicago is working on a plan for making the city more environmentally friendly, and that, in fact, that there are some buildings either already built or being built that have solar panels as part of their construction. That is, the sidewalls of the building have solar panels. I wonder what you could tell us about all of this.
I would be the last one to be able to fill you in on that. It's hard for me to believe that it could be at all significant as part of the total answer to the environmental issues, since Chicago is unlike, let's say, Phoenix, Arizona, is not known for the amount of sunlight we get each year per day. And so I find it hard to believe that it would be a major answer, and I just don't know what the facts and figures are on that right now. Obviously, most of the gains will be made by dealing with both automobile pollution and stationary pollution, but I think that Chicago right now is one of the most seriously polluted cities in terms of air pollution.
Is it the case that the mayor and the city are addressing this in an organized way, or am I just completely misinformed?
No, I think they are, and I think that the federal government is as well. And, of course, the federal government uses the spur of money to get states and regions to deal with local problems. A good example of that is Denver has just reached a milestone and is no longer on the endangered list, of as Chicago still is. Mm-hmm. So I think they are making every effort.
Is it the case, as far as you know, that the mayor has made a statement to the effect that he intends to make Chicago the greenest city in the country?
I have heard that, and it's pretty thrilling to see what he's doing. You know, he wants to, I mean, he's right in the middle of creating an incredible millennial park in Old Grant Park. It's going to be extraordinary, extraordinary garden. I think he has ideas of gardening for the old Meigs Airfield, which will not be with us much longer, as I understand it. So I'd say that is Chicago, the city beautiful, is a major theme of the mayor's.
Thanks a lot.
All right. What do you think, Mr. Johnson, about the proposal to renovate Soldiers Field?
This would be a very personal reaction, and that is that I think Soldier Field is in a terrible location for a sports arena. Most modern sports arenas have been built at the conjunction of major expressways, where ingress and egress are much easier than they will ever be at Soldier Field. So I would hope someday we'd find a way to relocate.
So you're among those who would say, rather than spend all this money to do the renovation, alter the building in a way some people think is inappropriate, it would be better to actually build another stadium someplace else.
That's my own personal view.
Okay. We'll continue here. We'll go next to someone in calling from the Chicago suburbs, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I want to say God bless all of you that are giving thoughts to the future. And so I wanted to ask a couple of things regarding the housing. I have a couple questions. I think that there should be some kind of plan that they don't break up only one type of neighborhood to make the accommodations for everybody. How much thought is there given to the different neighborhoods that there are? Are they going to make something that is kind of eclectic regarding housing, which I think we all need is to be mixed together? Mm-hmm. And then I have some other questions and some other comments.
All right. We have two major housing problems. One is a very broad scale one of the imbalance, the mismatch between housing and jobs, that a very sizable portion of the metropolitan population cannot afford to live anywhere near where they work. The work has gone out to distant suburbs, and they must make long commutes because, as you know, each city and village has its own zoning ordinance, and they can zone out lower-cost housing, even medium-cost housing. And so it's in the interests of a particular locality to get, oh, nice research parks, nice office buildings that don't bring in school children but pay big taxes, and then be tough on who can build houses at what cost. And usually the higher cost housing brings in less children per home. And this results in a horrible imbalance. And it's very anti-market. You know, for years, a century, we've had laws on the federal level that require companies to compete with each other. And so that I should be able to find the housing I can afford almost anywhere in the metropolitan area, but I can't. That's one big problem that we're trying to deal with, and we have some solutions aimed at that. And then you have the problem of the hyper-concentration of poverty mainly in certain pockets in Chicago. And there, a very hopeful sign is the tearing down of Cabrini Green step by step, and the replacement of those tall prisons with three-story homes, where you offer them at very low prices to the poor, and then cut rate prices to people in higher income levels to get to a situation in neighborhoods where people can live in economically integrated neighborhoods to some extent. Because the horrible, horrible thing that we've inflicted on the hyper-concentrated poor is that they can walk 10 miles and still be in a poor neighborhood and not ever see. When I was a child, I went to a common school where it ran from the almost poor to the almost rich. And I was right in the middle, but I could look up and see some hope. I thought, well, I'm as smart as that guy. He may be a lot richer than my family, but I've got brains and I'm getting the same education. That isn't true today. And so we really have to break up these terrible concentrated public housing projects, and that is underway. Unfortunately, it's a 15-year project, but we've learned a very costly lesson that we couldn't have done it a worse way than we did it. back in the 60s.
Do you have some address that people could write to you regarding any ideas that they have?
Yes. I'm hesitating a moment because I don't have it with me. But if would it be proper to get an address from you so we could send you some information?
If you would like, I suppose we can take the address of the caller, and then I think we can take the address of the caller. Otherwise, if that doesn't work, then she could drop us a postcard, and then we could pass it on.
Get it on to me
that way. One way or another, I think we can
all
manage
right.
it.
Well, where would the postcard be?
We are WILL Radio. And we are in Urbana, Illinois, 61801, and we're in Campbell Hall at 300 North Goodwin.
Okay. The other thing that I wanted to say is I'm against this cutting down on Miggs Field.
Mm-hmm.
The treasurer, Topinka, she spoke up and she says, you know, they really need that because the air congestion at Midway and at O'Hare, they have to send people here from Springfield to Chicago, and then when there are delays, that's costing all of us. Now, that's for each member that has to come up to Chicago.
Yeah.
Each time they have to wait for all these delays, they can go to Biggs Field and be there in time for their meetings and things like that, but if they cut out Miggs Field, there's going to be another problem. And I'm also wondering, what about the monorail?
Are you talking about a monorail that was going to be installed in downtown Chicago?
Well, I'm saying I think that we should make plans for a monorail. I don't know where or what, but I'm saying I think we should incorporate
that. We had a very serious effort underway that got killed about 4 years ago. That would have linked, it wasn't a monorail, but it was a rail system that would have linked the train stations, the train terminals in downtown Chicago with the near up to the near north side of Chicago. And it would have been a wonderful thing to be able to get off your train and get to your place of business with a minimum of trouble, with no need to be driving downtown. And it got killed in a political fight of the state against the city, unfortunately, and the cost grew rather horrendous at the time. But ultimately, that is a very sound answer. On Meigs Field, that is one of the most controversial issues I've known about, and certainly your friend who talked down there from that perspective has many friends in Chicago who would make the same argument.
Just very quickly on the airport issue, because, again, it's a story that we certainly have been following. Anybody who's flown through O'Hare knows how congested that airport is, and a couple of things have been suggested. One is the expansion of O'Hare so it could handle more traffic. The other is building a third airport, and Piatone seems to be the place that at least some people are backing. And this discussion seems to be sometimes couched as an either-or proposition, and each side has its proponents. You're in this plan, you're suggesting that probably we need to do both.
Yeah, there is no substitute for O'Hare, maintaining O'Hare as a premier hub for international flights. We cannot afford, Chicago cannot justify more than one such hub. And the economic vibrancy of Chicago depends very heavily on maintaining that status for O'Hare, and that means increasing the runways in some way. And Mayor Daley did come up with a plan that looked pretty good. So I'd be surprised if we don't. It'll take years and years, but I would be surprised if we don't make some expansion possible within the next 10 years at O'Hare. But of course, Piatone would be a different kind of airport, point-to-point airport, And even then, it wouldn't solve this lady's problem because the argument for Meigs is that people, either in high government positions or high business positions, find it very convenient to fly into Meigs for business appointments, and they make out economic arguments and efficiency arguments as to why it's unique, that you could never develop an airport like this today over the political opposition, and why is he giving up such a precious thing as this? Why is the mayor? So it's been a very controversial thing, and he just feels very strongly and philosophically that the lake, as was Burnham's plan, should be a place of beauty and a place of recreation.
We are almost out of time. I want to try real quick to do here a Champaign County line two. I'm sorry, we don't have much time, but
yeah.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I can't hear myself, but I guess you can hear me. That was one of the points I wanted to hit, is I think Meigs Field should be eliminated, and maybe a bullet train between St. Louis through Springfield would be the answer to that, and I think that would be the answer to a lot of the airport congestion, would take out the short hops and have better high-speed rail, but it's hard to persuade people of that. On the other end of the really magnificent museum campus, I guess as it's being called now, is the Millennium Park, which I hope doesn't get a corporate name, and that was the other kind of point I wanted you to address, is how municipal space and public space can be, you know, actually the city of Chicago as opposed to having a corporate logo on it, like United Soldiers Field or something, which I would like to see avoided too. But I'm glad you brought up the hyper-poor, as it were. It's also hyper-segregated. I think Chicago has the rank as the most hyper-segregated. And there are three zip codes in Chicago that have, this is hard to believe, but a median income below $2,000 a year. So that means that its unemployment rate is incredibly high. So I don't know, you talked about a plan to take care of low-income housing and having an 18-year scale. During the Clinton administration, the one-for-one thing for low-income housing was abandoned, and so when they're tearing these things down, they're not actually replacing units one-for-one. We are even having the discussion at the urban level here, or city level. Anyway, those are the kind of issues I wanted to have you address, and I guess I should have called in quite a bit earlier.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to say that we only have about a minute left here, and I don't know what you'd like to do with that minute.
Well, that bullet train point is extremely important. All over Europe, we now know that the bullet train works, and shame on the United States with its concentrations of population, both on the East Coast, from Boston down to Washington, and the Midwest. These are the two areas that the federal government has determined are obviously ripe for bullet trains. If we had connections between Detroit and St. Louis and Milwaukee and Cleveland, let's say, it would obviously do a great deal to relieve congestion. And the economics are pretty obvious that it would work.
We are going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. We could get into some other areas, but we've used our time. And we want to suggest again, of course, anyone who's interested in reading on this issue can look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled Chicago Metropolis 2020 by our guest Elmer Johnson. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Elmer Johnson, president of the Aspen Institute. Mr. Johnson, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Happy to do so.
And we also want to say thanks very much to the folks there at the University of Chicago Press for helping set up the high-quality connection there with our guest. This program, Focus 580, made possible in part by support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. In the next part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about